Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Jeff Gotthalf, an author of Lean UX and Sense and Respond, and co-founder of Sense and Respond Press, and we're going to talk about different design methods today and making them work together for collaboration. This episode is brought to you by Abstract, design workflow management for product design teams using Sketch. No more searching for the right version of the file, exporting and importing between tools, or trying to consolidate feedback. Now, everything is in one place. Sign your team up for a free 30-day trial today by heading over to abstract.com. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jane. Thanks so much for having me.
We're absolutely thrilled. And can you first tell us a little bit about yourself and where you got started and how you ended up being a co-founder of a publishing house?
Sure, absolutely. I started my career in the Web 1.0 days, originally as a front-end developer, which is a strong word. We did HTML, basically, and a graphic designer back in kind of the late 90s. I transitioned into information architecture shortly after that, spent about 10 years doing all kinds of UX and interaction design work, and then started moving into a bit more of the product management side of the house. And then working through a series of companies, I ended up working, doing a lot of work on the challenge of doing design and user experience in agile environments as agile picked up. And in the process of doing so, I was able to provide some answers to that question along with colleagues that I'd been working with. I wrote a book called Lean UX. That book was successful enough to really change what I did for a living. I began teaching the material in the book more so than doing hands-on design work. Since then, I've launched a consulting company called Neo that was around for about 4 years. And written another book called Sense and Respond, and then a third book called Lean versus Agile versus Design Thinking, which ultimately led to the creation of our publishing house that I co-founded with my co-author Josh Seiden, called Sense and Respond Press. And so that was a very, very short history of what I've managed to do in the last 20 years or so.
That's an amazing story. So as of today, which do you enjoy the most? It sounds like you enjoy the educational process more than hands-on work as of today.
Well, that's what I do much more of these days, is I do education in a variety of ways: consulting, training, workshops, keynote speaking, coaching with companies, coaching with executives. And that's the majority of the work that I do these days. And so the hands-on design work, sadly, to some extent, has taken a back seat over the last few years. But, I suppose I can pick it back up if I needed to.
Tell us a bit more about Sense and Respond Press. And the first analogy that comes to mind is a book apart. So is your idea somewhat different, or is it a different direction or a similar direction?
Sense and Respond Press was heavily influenced and inspired by A Book Apart. We looked at what they were doing, being very specific about a target audience, being very tactical about the topics they were choosing, and writing books that people could actually consume in a very short amount of time. To us, that was a brilliant model, and we really wanted to take that model and focus in on a different community. For us, we are focusing Sense and Respond Press on busy executives who are struggling with modern management challenges. So our books focus on digital transformation, business agility, innovation, and product management. And we look to have very short books that provide a lot of practical, tactical help for these executives as they wrangle the challenges of managing teams and managing businesses in a world where software has really consumed business.
Great. Well, could you give us an idea what the perfect book in your publishing house looks like? So like in terms of the number of words, what does it have inside? Any favorite titles that you'd like to highlight?
Absolutely. For us, it's 10 to 12,000 words. It's practical. It's tactical. It tells a compelling story, and it deals with a real challenge that managers, executives, and aspiring leaders are facing today. So for example, we've got a book called Making Progress, The 7 Responsibilities of the Innovation Leader, written by Ryan Jacoby. That book is dealing with, okay, you've been handed the innovation portfolio at your company. What do you do next? And there's 7 clear steps for what you do next when handed that portfolio. Another book that I really love, we recently published, is called Hire Women. And it's about using agile methodologies to ensure gender diversity on your teams and in your companies. And it's written by Debbie Madden, who is the CEO of her second company in New York City. And she's very well experienced in this particular space. Those are two that I really like and that really fit the mold of exactly what we're looking for at Sense and Respond Press.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing that story. I was really curious how that's going, because it's not, you know, people usually have a consultancy and a product, but publishing is something very, very interesting. So going back to those design methodologies that you definitely have mastered, and you've written a book on making them work together. So could you first give us an overview about Lean UX and Agile and design thinking, and how they are different and what they have in common first?
Absolutely. So I published a blog post called Lean versus Agile versus Design Thinking about 2 years ago. And that very, very, very quickly became the most popular thing I'd ever written on the internet until recently. It was only exceeded recently. But up until very recently, it was the most well-read thing I'd ever written online. And it started with a story. And the story was that I've been working with a client who was in a position of managing designers, engineers, and product managers. A client with the opportunity to train those people in any way that he saw fit. And what he did was he took his engineers and he trained them in Agile. And he took his product managers and he trained them in Lean Startup in the enterprise. And he took his designers and he trained them in design thinking. And then he sat back and he expected this magical synergy to happen where designers and product managers and engineers all of a sudden work amazingly well together. They collaborate. They have a shared vision. They have a shared cadence. They have a shared language. They have a shared focus. And none of that happened. None of it. And he came to me and he said, look, I feel like I did all the right things. You know, I trained everybody in these methodologies. What did I do wrong? Why is this not yielding the results that we expected it to have? And that really got me thinking. And that was the basis of that article to say, look, I mean, if you want to cut to the chase for a second, right? If you cut to the chase, the gist is that all of these methodologies have shared principles. The tactics that they advocate for vary from methodology to methodology, but the principles underneath them are very similar. And if you can build those principles into the way that your teams work, then all of a sudden, it doesn't really matter if you're doing Lean Startup in the enterprise or design thinking or Agile. What matters is that you're practicing or you're doing work in a way that uses these principles to maximize the productivity, the efficiency, and the success of these particular teams.
Could you give us a recap of what these principles are?
Sure. I mean, there's 10 of them in the book. I'm not sure I will go through all 10 of them in this particular call. But the short of it is this. There's a focus. First of all, we focus on customer centricity, right? So customer success and business success, or customer value and business value, are the same thing. That's one of the most important things to keep in mind as you start to transform the way that your company or your team does work. And this is something that comes out of Agile. Agile talks about satisfying the needs of the customer with working software. And this comes out of design thinking, which really focuses on developing empathy for the customer and making sure that you're solving a real problem for them in a compelling way. Lean Startup is also very customer-centric in that it measures success in terms of changes in customer behavior. Right? And so that principle sits across all 3 of these methodologies. Now you've got sprints in Agile, and you've got other kinds of activities in design thinking, and Lean Startup talks about MVPs and experiments. And you could argue when you do which and at what point, but the underlying principle is that customer value and business value are the same thing. So that's one. That's very, very important. Another one that's extremely important is how you measure the success of the work that you're doing. Now, traditionally, our manufacturing-based history has taught us that success is measured by the production of a product. In other words, we made the software, right? We launched the app, we shipped the system, something along those lines. That was always the measure of success. And that comes directly from manufacturing, right? When you were making a car, the measure of success is, well, we made the car, right? Right? And people transferred that directly to software. Now, that actually made sense to some extent when software was static. When I started my career, software came in a box, right? You went to the store and you bought software at the store in a box. In those days, the quantity of software that you sold mattered. Today, software is continuous. It never ends, right? We deploy software as much as we want. We were building systems as opposed to just these kind of project-based software products. And so what that means is that these systems can be continuously improved, continuously optimized. And so the question then becomes, how do we decide what to do? Which features do we add? Which features do we take away? And it's not the total quantity of features that we make that determines success. In other words, the amount of software that you make, what we call output, doesn't matter. In fact, you want to minimize that, because the less stuff you make, the less expensive it is, the less expensive it is to maintain, the easier it is to use, right? And what we want to optimize for are outcomes, these changes in customer behavior that tell us that we've delivered something of value. And that's one of the key principles that brings together Agile, Lean Startup, and design thinking, is changing the measure of success from we built a thing to we made a customer more successful, and we know this because they are now doing something differently in the system. Now, this is a simple concept that is extremely difficult to implement because most organizations simply, they don't plan this way, they don't budget this way, they don't reward their teams this way. Everything is based on the making of things. I'll give you one quick example, and then I'll kind of see what you think. But you take one team, okay? Now, if the name of that team is the iPhone app team, what's the goal of that team? In other words, what's the measure of success for that team?
Making a specific iPhone app.
Exactly.
I don't know. This question I've been struggling throughout my career, so I don't have an answer. But it's definitely not the time used. It's definitely not the time spent in the app. It's really so different for every kind of app and product.
No, fair enough. But if you're on a team that's called the iPhone app team, your job is to build an iPhone app. Now, if you take that same group of people, and instead of calling them the iPhone app team, you call them the mobile commerce team, what's the goal of that team?
Developing mobile commerce.
Right. Exactly. Increasing the amount of stuff that we sell through the mobile channel. Right. Now, that could be an app. That could be a native website. That could be geofenced SMS alerts. It could be beacons. It could be a thousand different things. Right. And it's our job as the makers of software, designers, product managers, engineers, to figure out what combination of code, copy, and design delivers that change in behavior, that outcome. And that's one of the key principles in unifying lean, agile, and design thinking, is managing the outcome.
That is a wonderful concept, definitely. Going from the deliverables towards the success measure and the activities and everything that you described so well. Thank you for instilling the concept for our listeners. However, the problem that your friend or colleague ran into was making these methods work together. And there's still a challenge because of the operational differences, right?
There is, yes. If you treat them as recipes, absolutely.
What is that secret sauce that allows you to combine those three and to recommend those three methods to work together for a team?
So I'm going to come back to managing the outcomes for a second, because it's the core change that makes it possible for these ideas to work well together. If you're managing the outcome, and I've asked you to increase mobile commerce by 15%, you don't know what you're going to make. And because of that, you and the team now need to go and discover what the best combination is of code, copy, and design is to drive mobile commerce. Now, that means that you have to run experiments. That means that you have to do research. That means that you have to talk to customers. That means that you have to do design. It means that you have to learn quickly, and you have to change course based on what you're learning so that you're not building things that don't meet customer needs and that don't elicit the behavior that you're looking for. All of those things that I just mentioned, those are activities of agile, of lean startup, of design thinking, of, you know, research, those types of things, right? So by simply changing how we measure the success of the team starts to do work across those three methodologies in order to achieve the goal. Now, yes, we can time box things, right? There's some really nice benefits of working in an agile way. Sprints, for example, right, are a terrific concept to time box the work, right? The work doesn't necessarily have to be writing code, right? But we want a block of time that says, in this block of time, we are going to do this work. And at the end of that block of time, we are going to reflect on what we learned. And we're going to then adjust course based on what we learned. That's Scrum. That's Agile. That's Agility, right? Those are sprints, retrospectives, and then, of course, iteration planning in an Agile way, right? So you're already doing Agile simply by implementing those very, very basic concepts.
Absolutely. We have an episode recorded a few slots ago that's going to go out about design sprints. So we're going to link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. So, design sprints is a terrific example of work you can be doing inside a sprint that's not writing code, right? And a design sprint allows you to build shared understanding, to do some research, to align the team in a particular direction, to create some prototypes, some hypotheses, right? That's lean startup kind of stuff. Maybe even to run a couple of experiments. Again, that's sort of lean startup, lean UX kind of stuff. And then based on what you've learned, to then decide what you'll execute next, right? And so those techniques that you run within the time box, within the sprint, can come out of design thinking. We're going to go do empathy interviews, or we're going to do customer observation. You might be in a position where you can write some hypotheses, testable statements about how you think you might solve the user problem, or design and execute some experiments so that you can determine how to best build the product to solve the customer need. All of these activities come out of design thinking or lean startup and can be done within the sprint. And remember, all of them are focused on the goal of making the customer successful, not the goal of shipping software. I'll give you an example. I was working on a team, this is years ago now, probably 10 years ago. I was working on a team whose job was to increase the amount of communication that was taking place in our service. Now, our service was a two-sided marketplace, so we had buyers and sellers. And we knew that when buyers and sellers communicated with each other successfully through our system, they used the product more and they would renew their subscription. And so we took a team and we said, your job is to increase the amount of successful communication in the system between buyers and sellers. That's all you have to do. Okay. We didn't tell them how to do it. We didn't tell them that they even had to build software. We just said your goal, and I'll give you the example here is the successful communication rate when this team started was 14%. So you've got two sides paying to use the system and only connecting 14% of the time, which is abysmal. It's terrible. And we said, look, your job is to hit 75%. Why 75%? Because it's better than it's better than 14, right? Like, that's it. That's the only reason we picked 75, because it was better than 14. And we knew that that was a metric that made customers more satisfied with the system and allow, and they would renew their subscriptions more frequently, okay? Now, that team worked on this initiative for 6 months. They worked in sprints. They ran experiments. They talked to customers. They launched some features. They killed some features. You know, and at the end of 3 months, they had shipped some features, and they had reached a communication rate of about 38%, which was better than 14, but not good enough. But they had learned so much about their user that they continued for another 3 months and then eventually hit 68%. Now, they did deploy software at the end of the day, but they didn't have to. We had access to a call center, and our user population was small enough where one of the options that the team entertained was to pull a report every month of sellers and buyers who tried to communicate but didn't reach each other, and pick up, have the call center call those people and manually make that connection. We considered that as a viable option. Why? Because that would change behavior, right? Now, unfortunately, that wasn't a scalable solution. We wanted the business to grow, and we couldn't grow the call center in such a way that, that would support this indefinitely. So we ended up launching software. But it was the team's job to discover, to brainstorm, to entertain all of these various ideas, and then to figure out how to change customer behavior for the better.
That's a great example. Really. I wonder, what if after learning for 3 months, they decided to focus on a different metric as a measure of success? Could that be possible?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the more interesting things that happens, and it happens more often than we care to admit, is that we set out to change some kind of customer behavior, and we find out that it's the wrong behavior to change. It's the wrong metric to measure. It doesn't have the kind of broader influence on usage that we expected, or it's too difficult to change, or it's as high as it's going to go, right? And in those situations, it's absolutely critical that we bring that evidence back to our leadership, to our stakeholders, and say, look, we tried to move this behavior forward, and it's not happening. And it's not happening because of these things that we've learned based on the work that we've done, right? This lean, agile design thinking work that we've done has generated evidence, right? This is not just our opinion, right? This is something that we've actually learned from our customer base or our potential customer base. And now we think that we should go after a different behavior based on that. So absolutely, that's a very real and a very fair conversation to have. And unfortunately, in a lot of companies, it's not a safe conversation to have, because somebody has got a bonus riding on that metric that they assigned to your team. However, it's the right conversation to have.
Once we're talking about metrics, this seems to be a very challenging topic because it's so unique to every business and it's really hard to provide a formula. But you have an experience, you know, of a 10,000 foot view of multiple businesses. So could you give us like your favorite, let's say, 3 to 5 examples of some metrics that were considered North Star in your projects or projects of your clients?
Absolutely. So the metrics that you're looking for, the metrics that are important, are measures of customer behavior. Again, outcomes. It's critical to repeat it. Outcomes are the metrics that matter are what people are doing or not doing in your system, right? So for example, I work with one company and they said, look, one of the metrics that we want to optimize for is homepage load time, right? And that's a metric. That's a number. And I said, great, what's good enough, right? When are you done optimizing the homepage load time, right? Because in theory, you could optimize it forever, right? What's fast enough? Is a tenth of a second fast enough? Is a hundredth of a second fast enough, right? At what point do we stop doing that work? And they said, well, we don't know. I said, but what happens when the homepage loads fast or it's perceived to load fast? Well, they said, oh, well, people, you know, they don't bounce off the page. They sign in more successfully. I said, great. Those two things that you just mentioned, those are outcomes. Those are measures of customer behavior, right? So let's optimize for bounce rate and let's optimize for number of successful logins. Now, one of the tactics we might use is homepage load time, but there's lots of other ways to do that as well, right? So again, the focus on metrics should be customer behavior. Now, the behaviors that we're looking for at the highest level, if I was to generalize it, right, there's a framework called metrics for pirates, pirate metrics. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah, R-A-A-R-R.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's a terrific sort of high-level framework into which almost every customer behavior in your system should fall into. So we've got, you know, acquisition is the first A, right? So how can we get people to the system? Can we get them to the product, to the feature, to the app, whatever it is, right? The second A is activation. Activation is, can we get them to use it? Then the first R is retention. Can we get them to use it again and again and again and to use more stuff? The second R is revenue. Can we get them to pay for it? Or can we get somebody to pay for it? And then, of course, the last R is referral. Can we get them to tell their friends or their boss or their internet? And kind of at the highest level, generally speaking, almost all customer behaviors fall into one of those five buckets. And those are really good measures of customer behavior to start with, regardless of the type of product that you're designing or building, even if it's B2B.
So there's the approach of the North Star metric when there is just one metric critical for the business. And then there is the approach when you have a metric responsible for each stage of the customer lifecycle, like you described, acquisition, activation, etc.
Well, if you take a North Star metric like retention, right? So say somebody really wants to drive retention, right? That's terrific, but there's all kinds of leading indicators that will tell you whether or not your retention metric is going to go up. Right? Mm-hmm. There's acquisition, there is the amount, the frequency of visits, right? The quantity of use within a product, right? So if it's, think Slack, right? Slack had this, their magic number was something like 2,000.
10,000 or 2,000, right?
right. Something like that, yeah. Right. It was one of those numbers, right? Within a certain time period, right? If a team sent X thousand messages in the first 2 weeks of use, they were hooked and they were staying on it, right? That drives retention. So you can optimize for that behavior in order to hit your North Star metric. So that North Star metric is great, but it's never standalone. There's always other leading indicators for it as well.
Mm-hmm. There are a few famous business stories. They're not specifically from the software world when focusing on something led to great success. And like a couple that come to mind are, one is this hotel chain focusing on providing the most spectacular sleeping experience. And the other one is the airlines that focused on just getting off on time being the primary goal. So neither of these are specifically related to customer behavior, even though they are wonderful business examples. So in the software world, do you relate to that? Or how can we translate that to customer behavior metrics?
To me, those are tactics. To me, those are tactics to drive things like loyalty, like referral, like retention. So, for example, always taking off on time, right? So, I fly a lot, and I fly a variety of different airlines. And over the years, you know, you try to pick the airlines that are consistently on time. That treat you well, that make for a good customer experience, right? Those are tactics that real world companies employ to change my behavior. There are, I don't know how many airlines fly out of my home airport, but there's probably dozens. And those are all my choices, but I tend to go with two or three specific ones each and every time because they've created the best experience that I've come to expect from airlines out of my home airport, right? So to me, those are tactics for getting me to change my behavior, right? So for example, right, take a company like Ryanair, right? Ryanair, again, this year for the sixth year in a row, was listed as the worst airline in the world, right? People hate them, and they print money. They make so much money, right? And yet people despise them and rank them as the worst airline in the world year after year after year. Why is that? Because what do customers ultimately care about? Do they care about legroom? Do they care about meals? Do they care about lounges? The overwhelming majority of customers care about price. They shop on price. That's it. And Ryanair knows that. And so they skimp on all the other things where, and their prices get people to come back. That's where they focus their tactics, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all about the kind of experience you want to create, the kind of brand you want to create, and then ultimately what tactics you use to enforce those values and get customers to perceive them.
And the metric would still be something as trivial as, you know, the flying frequency or something like that.
For sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for making that topic drift, because it was not precisely about the methods, but definitely very helpful because it's challenging for every business. So summing up, your secret recipe is not trying to separate and divide the methods, but rather trying to borrow the best out of each one and, you know, borrow the time frame method from the agile sprint and follow and borrow the experiment methods from the others.
Absolutely. And then ultimately unify the team around principles, not around recipes, right? Mm-hmm. So pick and choose the tactics that work best from each one, but work towards these unifying goals of customer success.
However, just going back to your initial story, it seems pretty exotic to me as somewhat a manager that your friend decided to pick different methods for their team rather than picking just one and trying to kind of adopt it globally over different teams. So your ultimate advice would be to try and marry these or still try and focus on one?
My ultimate advice would be to ensure that people are familiar with the techniques that each one of these methodologies brings to the table. And then to encourage them to experiment with different combinations of these techniques to create the best possible process for them.
One of the questions I had up my sleeve for you was like, do you have a favorite one? But it's obvious that your recipe is very far from that, and you just recommend borrowing the best from each.
That's right. That's right.
Well, thank you so much for this wonderful, meaningful conversation, Jeff. This was great. And wrapping up today's episode, where can people find your work online and you personally?
Absolutely. So thanks so much for having me. I'm super easy to find online. I publish monthly on Medium. You can find me on Twitter at jboogie. Don't ask, it's a long story. my personal website is guthealth.co. And then the publishing house, Sense and Respond Press, is at senseandrespondpress.com. And we're looking for lots of new authors. So if you're looking to publish that first book, we want to help you publish that first book at senseandrespondpress.com.
That's great. Thank you for sharing the links. We're going to include them in the show notes. Just one question about the submissions. Are you open to people who have already written something and published as a self-publishing option? Or do you were looking for authors to collaborate from scratch?
No. We're absolutely open to anybody and everybody.
Well, we hope that we can send some listeners your way then.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Well, thank you once again for your time. And this was super useful. Thanks again. Have a great day.
Thanks, Jane.